We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi there, hockey fans, and welcome back to RotoWire's signature NHL Hockey Pod podcast with Statsman and AJ. Friends, I'm Paul Bruno in Toronto, Ontario. You can follow me at Statsman22, and my co-host is AJ Scholes, who's a great follow at AJScholes24, based in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, near RotoWire headquarters over in Madison. You know, folks, just because you haven't heard us on this platform over the last couple of weeks in between rounds, I want to invite you to follow us on NR Exploits. We have become a smash on the DraftKings profile and platform. AJ, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on there and how frequently we're on and where people can find us?
Yeah, if you go to DraftKings YouTube channel, the Sweat, I believe the program is called, but it's their live YouTube channel every day from... I believe it's, I got to do my math here, Paul. It's 11 to noon, Eastern time. You can find us over there. And, we're on pretty much, we've been on pretty much every day the last couple of weeks talking about hockey, either the games that are happening that day, you know, futures around the corner. We do touch on a little bit of DFS in addition to some betting, options there too. So, yeah, it's a great thing to check out and having a lot of fun doing it. You know, other than the fact that I'm, you know, stuck with you every single day. I need some space. You know, just weekly is good enough for me, Paul. But, you know, it's been worth it. It's been a good time. And, yeah, we're having fun over there.
Well, you're a lucky duck. You're even going to have fun at our annual RotoWire Mixer. And because I'm north of the border, I can't join you guys this year. And it's killing me. It's killing my son, who is also employed at RotoWire. And our respective significant others were all really not looking forward to missing out on this whole thing. But we're looking for better days ahead, and the whole COVID environment seems to be getting a little bit easier to deal with, I'll say, as we are on the verge of summer here, and things are looking better in that regard. So really a lot of things to feel positive about, particularly if you're a fan of one of the four remaining teams. And that takes us into today's show, where we're going to look at three different things as our focus. We're going to review the four series that happened in the second round of the playoffs, and we're going to review all the award nominees with our predictions included. And then we'll also preview the third round of the playoffs, which got underway over the weekend with game one between Tampa and the Islanders, with a bit of a surprising result there that we'll talk about in a little while. The other semifinal begins tonight with Montreal in Las Vegas, and I'm hoping that the Knights just pound the Canadiens really quickly and get them out of my misery so I can go on with a normal hockey life, because too much Montreal is not good for this boy right here. AJ, the second round featured four series that were very, very interesting, and as it turns out, not very easy to call properly or get the right outcome if you look at what we thought was going to happen, the way things played out. So a number of interesting topics, I think, with each breakdown. We'll start with the Boston Islanders set. In the regular season, the Islanders won the series 5-3, but the Bruins won the last three games, and that gave us both reason to think that Boston was going to have a bit of an easier time with the Islanders. Instead, they got bounced in six games, and we were two games into that series the last time you and I spoke on this podcast, but the last four came out mostly in favor of the Islanders, and they walked away with this set. Your observations of a six-game series win by the New York Islanders?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, we talk so much about how the Islanders are defensive setup and goaltending, and all that's true. But they definitely found their offense, you know, in that six game series. You've got Kyle Palmieri turning back the clock with four goals and two assists. Matthew Barzal finally getting on the score sheet there with three goals along the way. And J.G. Pageau continued to thrive. And that's not even mentioning the second line. A little bit cooler, the second line than they had been in the previous series, but you know, Bailey, Nelson, and Bolivier again combining for another 13 points there in those six games. So really, I think the offense continues to roll, and I think that's what's been helping them. You know, if you've got Pageau and Palmieri going, that's three scoring lines, and that's very hard to match up with for anybody. And I think that's what happened in Boston. You know, that's a team led by one line there, and they added a second line with Krejci and Hall. So they were definitely better there this year. But then it tapered off after that even further. So I think it was just a matchup nightmare offensively, really, more than anything else.
And AJ, speaking about nightmares, you didn't mention the goalie situation for the Islanders. Sorokin gave you nightmares with the way that he helped them walk over the Penguins. And then they turned away from him, and they gave the reins to his partner, Varlamov. Semyon Varlamov took the reins in the series against Boston. I can't remember the last time a team won two series, but they did it with two separate goalies. That was a very intriguing aspect to me. Care to comment on that part?
Well, I think, you know, I think Varlamov, you know, was probably going to be the guy. But, you know, I believe if I'm recalling back correctly, he was dealing with a bit of a knock before that first series against the Penguins. And so I think the fact that he was, you know, feeling a little bit better, you know, he did come back, gave up the two goals, did okay in game two against Pittsburgh, really struggled in game three. So they let him kind of sit and take a break. And since coming back and taking over, he's been phenomenal. Just one loss in those seven games there. So really, I think it's the right call. Certainly, it was an interesting choice to flip. But that first game against Boston for Sorokin wasn't great either. He gave up five goals. And so certainly they had reason to switch.
And, you know, later on this summer, we're going to come back with some news and views about the free agency situation for all teams in the NHL. But the core of the Boston Bruins is getting a little older. And you heard some little whispers coming out of there that Tuukka Rask is reconsidering his options going forward. It's doubtful that he's at the end of the line, but you don't know. He's a bit of an enigmatic sort from time to time. And I wonder if this is his swan song. And then also you have to look at the fact that Patrice Bergeron is getting on in years. Marchand is in his early 30s, so he's got some runway left, I'm sure. You wonder whether Taylor Hall re-upped with this team. So there are a number of question marks in the Boston landscape that lead me to believe that it's going to be hard for them to be among the leaders of the Atlantic Division when it does reconvene in what we assume is a return to the divisions that we're familiar with.
Well, you mentioned Rask, you know, possibly retiring. I think the bigger concern is this off-season surgery. You know, he's going to be out until January at the earliest, could even linger into February. And at that point, like, does Boston even want him back? You know, from the standpoint, obviously he still has some in the tank. He played really well considering his injury, but like, do you want to keep him as like on LTIR for the start of the year after signing him? And then you have to figure out how to work him back into the mix. You know, are they going to go with Jeremy Swayman? Are they going to bring in a veteran other than Yaroslav Halak? Is Halak even interested in resigning after kind of getting edged out here? There are a lot of questions, and that hip surgery has complicated things to the nth degree for the Boston Bruins.
And, I mean, you got the Taylor Hall issue, AJ. He came there as a free agency gun for hire at the trade deadline, let's face it. Brought stability to their second scoring line but for a while, but then he went MIA in the second round of the series, and the Bruins hierarchy had to have watched that too and said, you know what, Are we going to plunk big money down on this guy, or are we going to kind of spread the wealth in terms of spending a little bit more on the average player that they can bring back? So really a lot of decisions, not just the goalie mix, but also what happens to Taylor Hall. He's expressed the desire that he'd want to come back. He felt that he found a home in Boston, but I think there's two sides to that situation, and we'll see how that plays out over the summer. But a lot of intrigue around the Bruins as they fade into the sunset. Meanwhile, we'll get more into the Islanders when we preview the next series, AJ, but the other set that we want to talk about, there's other sets in the first round we want to talk about. The next one is Colorado and Las Vegas. The first game of that series was a blowout. Colorado just roasted Vegas 7-1. But I thought it was a case where the Knights were really not ready to play after the grueling six-game set that they had against Minnesota, while Colorado got a cakewalk in their first round over St. Louis. I think that had a lot to do with the Game 1 result. And then halfway through Game 2 is when this series turned. I think everybody who watched it closely, including you and I, AJ, would come to that consensus. And Vegas showed not only could they play with Colorado, but they could outplay Colorado steadily. And the goaltending was in their favor. Marc-Andre Fleury on top of his game outdueled his counterpart, Grubauer, at the other end of the ice. I wouldn't have seen that coming as decisively as it was in the end of this series, I'll say. Those are my early observations. AJ, what stood out to you in this six-pack of games that saw Vegas win this series?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, you were a bit surprised by Marc-Andre Fleury winning that goalie duel. Certainly, I was not, as you like to say, me supposedly being the president of his fan club there. No truth to those rumors. But look, the thing is, this is not a particularly deep Colorado team. I mean, we knew that going into it. And they had some guys that stepped up in the postseason here. Brendan Saad had four goals in that six-game series. They got production from some blue liners, and obviously Cale Makar, we expected that. But Devin Toews chipped in 4 points. But, you know, especially when you don't have Nazem Kadri, who figures to be, when available, your second line center that just, you know, that's really going to hurt your depth that was already not great, to be perfectly blunt, regarding this team. And so I think that's something that they maybe need to look to, kind of figuring out, is how to get a third line. You know, if Kadri's healthy, they have two lines that, you know, obviously one's way better than the other, and that's not going to change. But if they can get themselves a third line, I think that's where you're going to see this team progress to the next level.
Well, AJ, I want to talk about the Kadri situation, because I saw this play out twice in Toronto, where he got suspended in the playoffs, consecutive seasons with the Leafs, manning their second line, and they were no match for the Bruins once that went down. And I think the same thing happened against Vegas, and not enough was made of that, I think, in the media. We did touch on it here, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we can mull it over a little bit in this spot too. But I think that was a key aspect in this outcome, because without him, Nichushkin and O'Connor didn't do much of anything. Saad as well on the wing, Burakovsky, they didn't get a lot of production from anybody outside that top line. As you suggested, it looked like it became a one-line team, and once you've got a one-line team in the playoffs, you can really focus your energies in terms of finding ways to minimize the damage from them, and that's exactly what the Knights went and did. Nathan MacKinnon is one of the best players in hockey, but he's not a one-man gang, and the same, you know, we saw this play out with guys like Matthews and McDavid in other series, where the opposition was able to key on one line and they were able to neutralize them effectively. And that's what happened in this series to really make it a decisive turn in favor of the Knights, and allowed them to end this series. I thought it was going to go the distance, but certainly I didn't concede the series to either side. I thought it could be a coin flip, but it was rather decisive at the end of days, and I think that's a big reason why that second line was neutralized, and the one line aspect of the opponent allowed for Vegas to run the table there pretty much the rest of the way. Tampa and Carolina, this was a series that I anticipated greatly. It was a 4-4 split in the regular season, AJ. Tampa won this rather quickly, though. Were you surprised by that?
Absolutely. I mean, I you know, Carolina won that division for a reason, and they had the the guy's capable of doing it if they could produce. But, you know, a guy like Dougie Hamilton getting one goal, no assists in five games, that's certainly not going to cut it for them. Andrei Svechnikov, Sebastian Aho, Tivo Teravainen all did fine, 13 points combined through five games. That's perfectly good for them. But after that, it really drops off. You know, Jordan Staal had 3 points. Jasper Fast had two. I mean, you're getting a sense of what happened here. And a lot of that has to do with the net mining on the other end of the ice. Andrei Vasilevskiy was just on top of his game. He's just a shade, like the smallest of margins behind Carey Price for the best save percentage in the postseason at .934. And he really just took over the series. You know, we saw games one and two, Carolina only scores one goal. Game five, they don't score at all. I mean, that's just vintage Andrei Vasilevskiy in goal there.
Yeah, and I think not enough was made of a comment that Dougie Hamilton said at the end of the series. We were beaten by a team that was $18 million over the cap, AJ. And we got to talk about that aspect because Nikita Kucherov has had an outstanding playoff. He's got points in 10 of 12 games and was a real factor in this series. He and Braden Point handled much of the offense that Tampa threw at Carolina. The Canes just didn't have enough answers for all the offensive weapons that were thrown against them. You mentioned the defensive side of the puck is where this series was actually won by Tampa with their goaltending and so on, but they did get some top-notch efforts from their high-end players up front as well. And I wonder if there's going to be some talk in the offseason by the NHL powers that be to prevent this cap circumvention, manipulation, use of long-term injury replacement money to level the playing field, because right now it's the rich clubs that can take advantage of this.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before, and I just don't see it. Yeah, you can kind of use it if the situation happens. But look, would they have preferred to have Nikita Kucherov, like, healthy all season long? Absolutely. Like, why would you not want that guy in your lineup? And so, yeah, they could look at maybe coming up with something. But then the flip side of that is if you're going to have to do – so say you get rid of it entirely, and maybe that's not the extreme they'll go to. But so Kucherov gets hurt. There's, you know, $9.5 million of dead money on their cap. Can they even call – like they're going to have to spend – teams will have to spend to $78 million or something so that you have – $2 million available for some less than, you know, quality player to just call, you know, be called up and fill the gap there. So it's going to really, if a star gets hurt, that team season's basically done. If you don't have any flexibility on it. So it's maybe not a perfect system either way. They probably have to come up with something in the middle here, but I just don't think it's that big of a deal overall for me. You know, yes, he missed the entire season, comes in, you add him to the playoffs, and it's a big advantage. But again, it's not like he wasn't injured and they just made it up, right? And, you know, the fact of the matter is any team that's lost a star player like that for an extended period of time would have preferred to have the guy available all season long. I think there's no arguing that.
And then just as we did a post-mortem on the Boston Bruins, I think one is in order for Carolina, but it's got a different outlook completely for me, AJ, and I don't know that you'll disagree, but this is a team that took some big strides this season, and they learned a very valuable lesson in the playoffs, I'll say. A lot of young guys here getting their first turn as frontliners to lead the attack. They had one of the more potent offenses. They have very sound six-pack on defense, and they had a pretty good 1-2 punch in the net. So a lot of pieces are in place, but is it a matter of just having to go through the process that so many other teams have done before they achieved the ultimate success in the playoffs? Is this just a big step in the learning curve for Carolina, or do you think they have some serious holes to fill? I don't see any weaknesses. They addressed their second-line center by adding Vinny Trocheck. He was nicked up a little bit in these playoffs. Jordan Staal gave them outstanding work as a third-line center, playing well at both ends of the ice, and so the offense was in order. Jacob Slavin, Dougie Hamilton, Brett Pesce, that's a trio that any team would love to have on their blue line. And then in nets, Nedeljkovic and Mrazek, a solid 1-2. So I don't think there's a lot missing there. But is there a missing link that you think that they have to find before they go to the next step? Or is it just a matter of time for this club?
Well, the missing link could be Dougie Hamilton. I mean, he's going to be a free agent. They just announced it, or it just came out today, that they're going to give him permission to talk to other teams right away. So, you know, for some sort of maybe sign and trade deal here, if he can find a deal. You know, I don't think it guarantees that he's gone. There's certainly the possibility that this allows him to kind of test the market and see what's out there and then decide, you know, I'm not going to make that much more as a free agent, so I'll stay for whatever Carolina's offering him. But that what happens there is a big concern, because you mentioned they do have a couple other capable guys. Their oldest blue liner right now is Jake Gardner at just 30 years of age, so he's got plenty of room there as well. They're not an old group by any stretch of the imagination. Nedeljkovic seems to be the netminder of the future. I guess there is questions, you know, does Mrazek want to come back to be the number two? Does James Reimer factor in as well? So there are some questions, but I think for the most part, I agree with you, Paul. I think for the bulk of the lineup, they're pretty much set, but there are some big pieces that need to be sorted out in the offseason here.
Geez, just a sec. I got to take out a couple of barbs from my side. You threw out the names of two former Leafs in that segment, and the Leafs are long gone in these playoffs. I got to hear Jake Gardner and James Reimer references from you. My God. Holy cow. Anyway, and to make matters worse, we got to talk now about the Montreal Canadiens again and their sweep over the Winnipeg Jets. Four games, AJ, and nobody saw this coming, even the Montreal's most ardent fans. But I did a Spockian eyebrow after that first game when they took the Duke 5-3 over Winnipeg, and I thought, oh, don't tell me what's happening now. And then we saw Carey Price basically take over and limit the Jets to three goals over the next three games. And in the last seven games, the Canadiens haven't even trailed in a game, and they're on the verge of an NHL all-time record for going without playing with the lead and without trailing in a game for an extended period of time in the postseason. I think if they go to the end of this game and take it wire to wire, they do set the record, in fact. So a stunning outcome from a team that was the lowest seeded team in terms of the overall standings in these playoffs. They're now one of the final four clubs, just to stick another dagger in me, I guess. But all credit to them, in all seriousness, AJ. They got four lines going. And when they showed the ice time of these lines throughout the playoffs, I saw very little in terms of a disparity between the first liners and the fourth liners in terms of the overall ice time that they were giving out up front. And that was a big part of their success, that they were just able to roll the lines. Meanwhile, Winnipeg, like the Leafs before them, lost their center in game one when Mark Scheifele wound up being suspended and thrown out of that game. And for the balance, essentially, of the Jets' remaining playoff games, it made them a one-line team again. Montreal's second straight series where they basically had that opportunity to negate one scoring line and really leverage their advantage in the nets as well. And that was the same recipe that they used. I don't know if they're in position to do that again starting the series tonight, but when we look at the way this series broke down, I think that's a big reason why the outcome was the way it was.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything you said there, Paul. For me, I mean, this series was over the minute Mark Scheifele decided to blow up Jake Evans. I mean, that was the end of this series. It's not a team that is built to weather depth problems. You know, the Jets, they limped into the end of the season without Nikolai Ehlers, and Ehlers is a fantastic player, but he's certainly no Mark Scheifele. And so you lose a bigger team here that just made their top six really non-existent. And to your point about Montreal and the minutes, if you look at the minutes for guys in this series, no forward logged over 18 minutes a game. Exactly to your point, Paul. It's even distribution. Actually, Jake Evans is the one guy that crept up towards that at 17:55, but then he didn't play the other games and the other three games in the series. So, I mean, they are rolling, as you said, those four lines. They're getting production across the board there. I mean, yeah, primarily right now it seems to be Toffoli, Suzuki, and Cole Caulfield that are leading the way. But, you know, guys like Brendan Gallagher have points. Eric Staal has points. Corey Perry. I mean, it's everywhere and throughout the lineup that they dispatch the Winnipeg Jets.
And, you know, we have to say something more about the Jets as we write them off for another season. It was a team that was threatening the North Division all year long, and before they faded down the stretch with a late season losing streak, and they didn't really rebound from that too well. And one of the guys that came under a lot of criticism in the playoffs in the late season was Pierre-Luc Dubois. And I'm shocked, AJ, that this guy didn't have a much better outcome to his year, even though, even when he was handed more responsibility in the playoffs, didn't respond and was moved around to try and get him to play on the wing instead of his natural center position, but didn't deliver the goods. And if there's really one concern there, one player that really didn't live up to expectation and really let down his teammates, it's Dubois, and he is justified in all the criticism that was heaped on him. They have one of the best goalies in hockey in Connor Hellebuyck, but defense is an area where I think they're going to look to upgrade because beyond Neil Pionk and Josh Morrissey, there wasn't a lot there in terms of quality. Certainly Logan Stanley is a big imposing guy on the blue line, and he got a couple of goals in a game against the Canadians, so made his mark in that regard. But I think they want to look at upgrading that part of their team more than any other. I think they have a top six pack when they're all healthy. Scheifele's loss was something that nobody anticipated. And so they have a lot of pieces again going forward. But getting Pierre-Luc Dubois right and strengthening up the defense is where I think this team will be focused in the offseason.
See, I disagree, Pod. I don't hate the defense that they have here. And, you know, yes, they could upgrade. You know, they don't have a big name guy necessarily, or even they've got the two. They could maybe use a third. But, you know, I don't hate their defense. I think the bigger problem for me is they need another, you know, top nine winger so that they can put Pierre-Luc Dubois back at center, have him play with Kyle Connor, and, you know, maybe that's where you put Mason Appleton or Matthew Perreault, and then you put Paul Stastny with whoever this top nine winger that you go out and get could be. And that would give them three lines, you know, and capable of having some more depth here. There just isn't enough depth. The only way they made themselves have a top six is by putting Pierre-Luc Dubois or Paul Stastny, they switched it up, putting one of those guys on the wing. And that's not the right solution, in my opinion. You know, for you traded one of the best, you know, he had a rough season, but one of the top wingers in the league for a center. Play the guy at center. I mean, that's what you did. If you wanted a winger, you shouldn't have traded away a winger. You brought in a center, let him play center. And so that's what I think they need to do, is they need a top nine, maybe a top six guy, so that they'll have three full packs of guys. You know, you'll have, he'll miss opening night, but you'll have, you know, Connor, Scheifele, Wheeler. You'll have Ehlers, Dubois, and maybe somebody else. And then Stastny, if he resigns, and one other guy there. And I think that's the biggest thing that I see as being deficient on this team. There's just not enough depth.
Yeah, when they made that trade, you made a great point. We looked at it and said, boy, look at the center depth that they have on this team. But there wasn't one game where they played the three guys at center from the time the deal was made. For whatever reason, they were trying to get the load up on the top two lines. And I think that was a bit of a tactical error. They could have really flexed their muscles on the center depth and filled in on the wings a little bit differently, is the message that I'm echoing, I guess, AJ, in terms of what you're saying. So we've given our postmortems on a few teams. We've reviewed all the series that happened in that second round. We'll take a break now, AJ, and then we'll come back, go through the award winners, and then preview the third round, which got underway. So let's take a few minutes for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back to take a look at the remaining teams in our weekly deep dive into key information. You're listening to Puckcast with Statsman and AJ.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Okay, we're back on Puckcast with Statsman and AG to take a look at the 2021 award nominees. A lot of this information was shared during the last few days, and we'll go through a list of all the nominees and all the major trophy winners and give our slant to who we expect to win. A number of players were repeated nominees, multiple nominees, I should say. So you'll hear their information a couple of times. We'll go through this fairly quickly, AJ, and then we'll get on to the next round. The beginning, the first award that we'll talk about is the Vezina Trophy, going to the top goalie. The nominees were Marc-Andre Fleury, Philip Grubauer, and Andre Vasilevskiy. No surprise there among these three guys. You want to break them down, AJ, and give us your pick, and I'll echo mine.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for me, you know, I think the fact of the matter is it comes down to, you know, games played here. You've got Andre Vasilevskiy played in 42 games. Picks up the 31 wins that leads the way. Grubauer with 30 wins. Marc-Andre Fleury with 26. You add on, you know, of the three guys, Grubauer does have the best save percentage at .922, but Vasilevskiy comes in just above Fleury at 925 before Fleury's 928. The goals against average, that's the one category where he's maybe a little high. You know, compared to the others, he's the only one that's over two. Grubauer comes in with the seven shutouts. So I think when you break that all down, yes, Vasilevskiy had one more win than Grubauer, but Grubauer had two more shutouts than him, better save percentage, better goals against average. And I think it'll be Philip Grubauer that takes it home.
I agree with you, AJ. He came up out of nowhere this season to dominate the goalie situation, and he had to because he was without a backup, a credible backup, much of the season. And that's something that you didn't mention, but I will throw in there. Fleury was backed by Robin Leonard. You can make the case that Vasilevskiy was only spelled occasionally by Curtis McElhinney there too, but I give Grubauer a ton of credit for backstopping this team to a dominant division win and rather a strong finish in their division. They tied with Las Vegas in terms of the overall standings, losing out on the tiebreaker, but I think that you have to give, actually Vegas lost out on the tiebreaker, didn't it? Columbus got the whole thing, didn't they? Yeah, yep. They did. Okay, so Grubauer led his team to the overall flag, then, you can say, and so that deserves a ton of recognition in my view, and so I echo your pick that he should be the guy that walks away with the trophy over the defending champ Vasilevskiy, and certainly an annual credible option in Marc-Andre Fleury. Three top-notch goalies, to be no question about it. The next award that we'll talk about is the MVP vote by the players. Top player in the league. It's called the Ted Lindsay Award after the Hall of Fame Detroit captain from a bygone era in the 50s. The three candidates that make the grade include two of our favorite players, Sidney Crosby, Austin Matthews, and Connor McDavid. And AJ, I'll run through the numbers here. Crosby with 24 goals, 38 assists, plus 22 power play points and a plus 8. Matthews led the league with 41 goals, 25 assists, a plus 13 power play points and plus 21. And McDavid ran away with the scoring title with 33 goals, 72 assists, 37 power play points, and a plus 21. I'm giving this award to Connor McDavid, quite simply a highlight reel waiting to happen on a nightly basis. And the distance between him and the next highest point getter, his own teammate, was reminiscent of the margin that you used to see for guys like Gretzky and Lemieux. That's the company that McDavid put himself in with the year that he had.
Well, I always look at MVP, you know, maybe I'm a traditionalist in this sense, but most valuable player. If you don't have McDavid, you still got Draisaitl. If you don't have Matthews during the year, you still had Tavares or Marner or a couple of other guys. Crosby put up those numbers playing without Evgeny Malkin for a good chunk of the season. So for me, I would pick Sidney Crosby. Now, do I think he's actually going to win? No, I agree. I think ultimately it'll probably be McDavid taking the Lindsay home for the third time. Now, I will say, if it is Sidney Crosby, that will put him in a group of just him, Mario Lemieux, and Wayne Gretzky, who have won the Lindsay four or more times. So I think a good case could be made for him as the most valuable player to his team this year.
I was wondering how you'd put your spin on this to favor your guy, and you did it in fine style. I'm not going to criticize that at all, but it affords me the opportunity to rebut by saying Austin Matthews had 8 more goals than McDavid. They played the same schedule, and in terms of top goal scorers in the league, don't forget Matthews walks away with the Rocket Richard trophy and earned his recognition as one of the top 3 guys according to this MVP list that we read on the Lindsay Award. So both our guys looking good as top players in the league in the regular season, but they're not playing now. The Calder Trophy, the best rookie on the season, AJ. There was a goalie and 2 wingers in this mix, so why don't you break it down for us a little bit with the numbers?
Well, yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing here, you know, how do you evaluate a winger versus, you know, versus a goalie? So for Nedeljkovic, the biggest thing is, you know, 15 wins and a decent, you know, save, 3 shutouts, 1.90 save percentage, 0.932 or 1.90 goals against average, 0.932 save percentage here. So I think it's trying to evaluate that versus the offensive side of the piece, right? Because clearly, at least in my opinion, I think it's very clear that from the winger standpoint, Kaprizov outpaced Nick Robinson here, and I think it's pretty straightforward in that sense, that it comes down to whether you want the goalie to win it or the winger. For me, 27 goals on the year, 24 assists for a 51 point campaign, that's just astronomical for a rookie to come in and do that. Robertson, for his part, 17 goals, 28 assists. So I think he's out of contention for this 100%. Kaprizov's numbers are just so much better than his. So that's where I land. I think Kaprizov will take it home. His numbers were just so good. I don't think Nedeljkovic played enough, if I'm being totally honest here, during the regular season. And so I think that's also a factor as well here. Like I said, 15 wins, 5 losses, 3 overtimes in just 23 games played. So for me, it's Kaprizov.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. He was instantly installed as a top 6 guy. Robertson had to work his way up to that level, and his full marks for being on this list. But I think the disparity between their goal scoring is indicative of just how important Kaprizov was to that offense. And he gets the Duke here as the Calder Trophy winner for me as well. The Lady Bing Award, the most gentlemanly player in the game. This is basically, you score a lot, you don't get in the penalty box too much, is the way it breaks down for me, and in simple terms. And Austin Matthews is in this mix against 2 defensemen. It's not often you see defensemen up for this trophy, so interesting call there. So if you look at just the offensive numbers, Matthews is the clear winner here, but I'm going to give it up too for the defenseman. Jacob Slavin has been a real nice addition ever since he came into the Carolina mix, and has been a dominant defensive defenseman in this league this past season. A plus 22, only 2 penalty minutes. It's hard to play 50 games and only get 1 minor when you're playing defense against the fleet-footed forwards that come your way on a nightly basis. So that deserves some recognition. And Jared Spurgeon, you can't say enough about what this guy did for his club, too. Minnesota wouldn't have been where they were in the standings without his play. He contributed offensively to the tune of 7 goals and 18 assists, 9 power play points on the season, 6 penalty minutes for his ledger. So the defensemen who play the game as much as these guys do, they get a ton of ice time, not creating any fouls against, as I say, high-octane offenses on, and fleet forwards every night. Tip of the hat to both of them. But I'm going to go back to my guy, Austin Matthews, and say he played against tough checking every night, didn't lose his cool all year long, and still led the league in goal scoring. And he's up there for a couple of awards. I think this is going to be a default pick in his favor because he's going to be up the track on a couple of the other ones where he's nominated. So I think Matthews gets the Lady Bing.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to make a case for, for Slavin in part due to the minutes, right? So he plays, my initial thought was that defensemen play more minutes. That's generally how it goes. And to only get 2 penalties in 52 games playing big minutes like that, that's huge. But Austin Matthews plays over 20 minutes a night. I mean, 21 and a half is actually right about his average. So, I mean, that's close to defenseman numbers there in terms of that. So I do think it has to go to Matthews. I don't think you can knock the fact that, he plays less minutes than a defenseman because he really doesn't. And so I'll agree with you, Paul. I think Austin Matthews takes home the Lady Bing.
Your Leaf sweater is in the mail, buddy.
Sounds good.
All right. The Selke Award is next, the best defensive forward in the league. There are 3 candidates here. When you think about each of these 3 guys, I think offense too. Barkov, Bergeron, and Stone are the nominees. AJ, why don't you break it down and give us your pick, and I'll give you my thoughts afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, Bergeron obviously has won this multiple times. I believe 4 times he's won this. Barkov and Stone, not so much on their side of it. And so I think for me, I think that should be a factor. One of the things that I'll point out with the Selke is that Bergeron is currently tied with a Habs great, if you will, Bob Gainey for 4 wins. And they're tied for the most all time. And so I kind of feel like it should maybe stay at 4 apiece. So for me, I'm just going to eliminate Bergeron from the discussion. If I was a voter, just from that standpoint, other than that, I think Barkov and Stone have pretty similar numbers. Stone is a plus 26. He's got the best plus minus of these 3 guys. Put up plenty of offensive points of his own. And so for me, I think that tips the scales, and I'll go with Mark Stone for this one.
Yeah, Bergeron, for his part, is the lowest among the point getters in this category. He's tied with Barkov. So Stone outproduced them offensively. Not that this is an offensive award, I'll repeat, but I don't know how you come off Bergeron, AJ, so quickly, because this guy's established his reputation as in the modern era as the best two-way player in the game right now. When I think of Stone, I think still offense, rugged player, and just because he's playing on such a potent line, I think that was a big reason why the plus 26 number comes up on the plus minus. Ditto for Barkov, and his plus 12 plays with a very dynamic offensive line as well, and not yet known the way Bergeron is. I think it's between Barkov and Bergeron. I'm going to give it to the guy who is linked most closely to the award in the modern times, and that's Patrice Bergeron for me. The Masterton Award is to the player most dedicated to hockey. It's not so much about points in this case, so I don't want to really talk about the point situation, but more the backstory on each of these guys. We have Matt Dumba, whose name and presence came to the forefront with the whole notion of the Black Lives Matter for leading the parade of players of color and of different ethnicities who are dotting the landscape more frequently now and showing that this game is truly for everyone. I think he's at the forefront of that list of players and certainly distinguishes himself with his on-ice performance. Then you've got Lindblom of Philadelphia. This guy had a really big scare with cancer, and the fact that he came back to play in the NHL following the big challenge that he had and the adjustment to combating this disease and getting over it and then coming back is kudos to him for sure. And then you have Patrick Marleau, who set the record for career games played in the NHL. He's played the game at a high level for many, many years. Some might say this past season certainly wasn't one of those, but I think you have to look at this as maybe a farewell performance for a distinguished career in the NHL. And I don't know if it applies to the Masterton Award or rather a career achievement thing. So I'm going to give the award to Dumba in this case for the fact that he's leading a new era of hockey players into this NHL.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the thing is you can look at these and, you know, they each kind of check one, like my first reaction is they check one box more than the other. So perseverance, sportsmanship, and dedication to ice hockey are the three kind of qualities here. You know, perseverance with Lindbaum, obviously, you know, to overcome the cancer diagnosis and come back. Sportsmanship with Marlow for how many games he's played and how long he's been around the league. And you know, everybody loves Patrick Marlow. And then dedication to hockey in Dumba for trying to grow the sport among people of color and to branch out from, you know, the more traditional hockey ethnicity, essentially, for lack of a better way to put it. And so I think I agree with you. I'm going to give it to Dumba here, but I certainly don't think there's any reason that the other guys couldn't win. And I certainly wouldn't be upset or disappointed if one of the other two guys won.
Very well said, partner. The Norris Trophy, the best defenseman in the NHL. Of course, we talked a lot, and we will talk a lot in the playoffs about Hedman and Makar. But Adam Fox of the Rangers had a fantastic year, leading all defensemen in terms of points with 47. Hedman finished with 45, Makar with 44. I'll point out also, Makar did his 44 in 44 games played and didn't get the ink that Hedman did all season long. I think Makar gets the award this year, AJ, because of the high level of play that he's shown in the regular season and the fact that he missed all those games and still was within an eyelash of scoring just as many points as the other guys is a credit to him as well. So I'm going to give it to the Colorado defenseman on that basis primarily.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you there, Paul. You know, you look, you know, maybe plus minus if you want to try and differentiate. Hedman was only a plus five compared to Fox at 19 and Makar at 17. Power play points, they're all right there. Hedman led the way with 24, Fox 23, and then Makar 22. And so I agree. I think it comes down to the fact that he played less games, a point per game average. So if you want to look at it at that way, he was the most productive defenseman when he was in the lineup for the year.
And the Hart Trophy, this is the media votes on this one for the most valuable player in the NHL. Nate MacKinnon, Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, certainly the offensive numbers are there in each case, and what they did for their teams has been well documented. I think you got to give it to McDavid as by far and away the most productive scorer in the NHL. I'm talking total points here, not just goals. Otherwise, I'd have given it to my guy, Matthews. And MacKinnon is as worthy a candidate as the other two guys in terms of the value that he has to his team. And I know that that's something that is in the definition. But I think I have a hard time not giving it to Connor McDavid after the year that the regular season that he put together.
Well, I'm going to go back to what I said. The same reason I gave the Lindsay to Crosby, I would give the heart to MacKinnon. I think he's more irreplaceable on his team than the other two guys here. And you know, they struggle when he's out of the lineup. And you know, you mentioned the point totals. You know, he's another guy that played a couple fewer games here. And so I think, you know, MacKinnon for me, good point totals, played a couple less games, and those were not some good games that they had without him. So,
and then finally, the award for the best coach in hockey. To my mind, Barry Trotz should have been on this list too, AJ. It seems that to me, he's been the best coach in hockey for years, but we'll go with the names that are on this list, and that's Rod Brind'Amour, Dean Evason, and Joel Quenneville. All three of these guys, former players and not so far removed from the game. So maybe that's a trend that we'll see more and more going forward. But for me, Rod Brind'Amour is a guy, every time I see a clip of this guy talking, it's with such a passion, AJ, that I think that his players got to be primed to go through walls before they hit the ice when he just gives one of his impassioned pregame speeches and talks. He does it with such an intensity. They show him in a dressing room, he's constantly moving and just a bundle of energy, and he probably translates that well onto his players. And it's no wonder, particularly at home, they just fill the other end of the rink with shots on goal. He's got them coming out of cannons with the motivation that he brings to the table. Dean Evason's gotten the most out of his club in Minnesota, more than I thought he would, in fact. So credit to him. And Joel Quenneville, well, what can you say about this guy? He's been well decorated as a Stanley Cup champion coach, and he certainly has led the Panthers to the top of their division this season. They were in contention for it, and they'll be in contention next year when they go back to the Atlantic. And a big reason why is Coach Q, one of the best in the league. But for my money, Rob Brind'Amour gets it this year.
Absolutely agree with you there, Paul. And you made the cases for it here. I don't need to say any more about that. Rob Brind'Amour wins it for me as well.
All right, then. Well, let's get to what's the main course on the menu, and that is the two series that are underway. We started with game one of Tampa and the Islanders. Buddy, why don't you go through the goaltender mix, and where do you see an edge here, if any at all?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, it's hard not to see an edge with Andrei Vasilevskiy, and I talked about his outstanding numbers in the postseason here. He's just been heads and tails. A big reason why they've gotten to where they are. So I do give the edge to him, but I will say that, you know, Varlamov, for his part, we anticipate it'll continue to be Semyon Varlamov at this point. He's got a .929 save percentage, 2.04 goals against average, and or that was the regular season, I'm sorry. So the playoffs, Varlamov's number is .930 save percentage. A little bit high on the goals against average at 2.43. You'd like, obviously, to see that lower, but I have to give the edge to Barley, or Vasil.
Vasilevskiy clearly going to be playing every game for Tampa, and then that's my question for you, partner, when looking at this series, is if Varlamov gives up a big number, do we see Sorokin replace him in a following subsequent game on game? I mean, the Islanders got the first one largely on the strength of what Varlamov did, but say he gets beat for a six spot, do they turn to Sorokin in the next game, or will they get Varlamov back in the nets?
I think they seriously could. I think they'll, if Varlamov has a really bad game, I do think it's not impossible that we have not seen the last of Ilya Sorokin.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree there. So it's a bit of a 1-2 punch that Islanders have in reserve. And not that I'm wishing any ill will on Varlamov. He was outstanding in the last series and in the first game of this set. But it's just another bullet that they have in their chamber that the Tampa does not. So when you're looking at this series and the goalie mix, certainly Vasilevskiy, the best of the three, I'll say. But the Islanders have a 1-2 punch that the Tampa Bay Club certainly doesn't have in their holster. In terms of breaking down the defensive depth here, well, I think that it's pretty safe to say that the star power resides with Tampa and Victor Hedman. And I mean, behind him, Ryan McDonagh, he's a few years removed from being a centerpiece defenseman in the New York circumstance. Since he moved over to Tampa, he's more well-known for his work on the defensive side of the puck as opposed to being an offensive contributor. And then they have Mikhail Sergachev, who is learning from both of these veteran guys to shape his game. I think he's going to be a dominant defenseman in this league for years to come, but certainly has an offensive upside, the likes of which maybe the whole Islander squad doesn't have. So they've got three credible pieces on the back end, and four or five, even if you add the likes of Savard and Cernak. Savard has played some power play time in his career. Cernak is a guy who's coming into his own and is a top four defenseman in Tampa and can play a little bit at both ends of the ice. So I think in terms of overall game, there's much more offense to like from the Tampa circumstance. The Islanders, more of a shutdown D-core, top to bottom. When you consider Adam Pellick and Ryan Pulock, I like to call these guys maybe the best shutdown pairing in hockey. They're going to be on the ice for upwards of 23 to 25 minutes a night in this series and try to take down one of the two offensive juggernauts of the scoring lines on the Tampa's club. But then it doesn't drop that much when you consider Nick Leddy's been around the league for a while, and he's probably the best offensive defenseman they have here, and Scott Mayfield partners with him to give them another credible shutdown pairing. And there's even a third one with Andy Green and Noah Dobson filling out the top six. So really a tough six-pack for any opposing team to kind of get through. It kind of reminds me of the minefield that Montreal offers with their big trees on the back end. We'll get to them shortly. But I see an offensive edge for Tampa, but maybe on the the defensive side, I give a slight edge to the Islanders in terms of breaking down the defensive acumen of these groups.
Well, I would just add, like, don't sleep on Noah Dobson. This is a guy, he's got 7 assists in the 13 games here. 4 of those have come on the power play, so he's getting, you know, some big minutes there. And so he's maybe the one player that I think can add some offense from that blue line. Certainly not to the level of Victor Hedman, but I do think there is some offense there. In terms of the forward complement, I'll take us right into that, Paul. You know, you've got for the Islanders, I'll start there. You know, I talked about the depth that they're able to offer. Leo Komarov, Matthew Barzal, and Jordan Eberle. Eberle and Barzal really found their offensive games in the second series there. Bolivier, Brock Nelson, and Josh Bailey as the second line have been cruising throughout the postseason. And then you add in a third scoring line that seems to finally have found its way in Kyle Palmieri, Jean-Gabriel Pageau, and for now, Travis Zajac. I assume if Oliver Wahlstrom is cleared to play at some point, he's likely to slot in for Zajac in that spot, but right now out. And then, of course, their fourth line has gotten all the press about being, you know, the best fourth line in hockey, and Matt Martin, Casey Cizikas, and Cal Clutterbuck. So this is a really deep team that's got some really quality offensive players. Again, you know, I said earlier, they get talked about the defensive side of the puck, but they've got plenty of offense here. They don't have the big names that you have in Tampa. And obviously Nikita Kucherov on that top line with Braden Point and Andre Palat. They've got Steven Stamkos as their star on the second line with Anthony Cirelli and Alex Killorn. Now, here's where I might give the Islanders a bit of an edge, because, you know, I just don't think Barkley, Gaudreau, Yanni Gord, and Blake Coleman is at the same level of the Islanders' third line. And obviously, you know, the fourth line is got some grit to it, and Patrick Maroon, Tyler Johnson, and then Ross Colton rounding out that group. But I do think the further down you get in the lineup, I think it does trend a little bit more in the Islanders' favor here.
Yeah, I think you can't speak enough to what Jean-Gabriel Pageau has meant to lengthening their offense on the island. And Travis Zajac has yet to get on track in these playoffs. He's just he's been known as a strong playmaking center much of his career, but he got shifted to the wing in this setup. And then Kyle Palmieri has already shown his value in these playoffs as a top offensive producer, and that's a pretty nice recipe for a third line. To me, the third line you mentioned on Tampa's side is kind of more a higher octane version of the fourth line of the Islanders, if you will. They play the game the same way, but they don't score very much, and so that's the edge that the Islanders' third line does have. In terms of the six-pack up front for Tampa, I think you got to give them the edge over the six-pack of the Islanders, but it's not as big as it once was, particularly with Barzal and Brock Nelson, a tremendous 1-2 punch that is scoring together at this stage in the playoffs. And people look at Leo Komarov's name in that top six, AJ, and they say, what the heck's he doing there? But he's doing a lot of the spade work, though, just like a guy like Zach Hyman did for the Maple Leafs top six forwards. And that's why he's earned a place there. He's giving space, creating space, and doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the corners and on the defensive side of the responsibility, so the guys like Barzal and Eberle can freewheel a little bit offensively. So you can't really sell that part short. And you remember when they scored that go-ahead goal, it was on a line change, and Barzal just made a beeline for the offensive blue line, not worrying about the defensive responsibilities that were just creating that opportunity for him. So the change of possession, he just took off like a bolt, because he says, I'm on offense here, and turned that play into a quick goal off a line change. So it just speaks to the value of the defensive conscience that's behind him and allows him to play that way. So anyway, we break down this series position by position, but when it comes to making the prediction on the series outcome, even though the Islanders lost Game 1, I'm still saying Tampa's going to win this series, AJ. They just have too many weapons up front, and I give them the edge in terms of the offense from the back end, and certainly we've got to give them a little bit of an edge in goal, too, although it's pretty close. I'm going to give the defending champs this series in 6 games. What's your call?
Well, let's see. What happened for the Islanders in the first round? They won in 6. What happened in the second round? They won in 6, and I think I'm going to stick with that trend. They're going to win here in 6. We already saw them steal Game 1 in Tampa. I expect the Lightning will come back. They'll win Game 2. They'll potentially split on Long Island, and it'll go home. Tampa will take Game 5 at home, And then they'll close it out in six. So, I think Isles in six, just keep rolling.
All right. So we're going to see a new champion, according to you. I hope to hell it's not Montreal. Don't make me talk a lot in this next segment, okay? Why don't you lead us into the discussion of the goalies between Montreal and Vegas, two guys with a French-Canadian background Canadian background, let's say. Marc-Andre Fleury at one end and Carey Price at the other end. Of course, Price comes from the western part of Canada, and he's the darling of Montreal fans, though, right now, and people in that province, though, at the moment, over one of their own, and that's Marc-Andre Fleury. So, a tough one to break down.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to give either side an edge here, right? You know, you look at, you want to talk, you know, career wins. You've got Fleury at 492, Carey Price at 360, so a little bit further behind, but four less years in the league. So certainly he could be a factor in the top, you know, if you give him an extra 4 years, certainly he'd be right there in the mix. So it's hard to really give an edge in terms of statistics and player, you know, player breakdown. So I'm going to go X factor that gives the Golden Knights the edge. And that is simply the fact that Carey Price doesn't have the same level of hardware as Marc-Andre Fleury, specifically those three Stanley Cup championships. The Flower knows what it takes to get it done. And I think that's maybe the one slight edge, but it is thinnest of margins that I would give him the edge there.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that one of these guys is going to lose four out of seven, because you look at them and you think, how hard is it going to be to beat these guys four out of seven games in each case? So it's going to be a telltale sign, but I think it's a wafer thin advantage, and I might even give it to Carey Price the way he's playing right now, out of his mind level of play in the last seven games that they've played, all wins actually. So when we look at the defense corps, I mentioned the trees on the back end for Montreal. I'm talking about four big defensemen who are their top four guys back there, and Shea Weber, Joel Edmondson, Brett Kulak, and Ben Chiarot. Only Weber is a guy that you might mention as a credible offensive piece, but even that side of his game has been wanting in these playoffs. I think he's playing hurt, to be honest with you, AJ. And so the way that they are performing, though, they kind of collapse around Price, and they've made it a minefield in the close area in front of the net. And they're saying to Carey, you handle the long shots. We'll make sure nobody gets in too tight. And that's the way that they've chosen to play. They've added a different look on their third pairing with Alexander Romanov finally getting into this playoff. Fans were clamoring for this youngster to make an appearance. Finally, he does, and he looks like he's entrenched now as a third pairing guy with Erik Gustafsson, another guy whose best game assets are his offensive side. So these guys will be insulated. It's the four pack ahead of them that's going to play a lot of the minutes, but they offer quite a change of pace and a bit of a wild card look. They can both play on the offensive end of the ice, and I wonder in a matchup game if Vegas is going to look to try and isolate these guys in as many defensive starts or defensive zone traps as they can, so that the top six in Vegas forwards can take advantage of the fact these guys are a little bit soft defensively. So that's the way I break down their side. On the Vegas side, there's the star power there on that group, and that begins with Alex Pietrangelo, Alec Martinez, and Shea Theodore, a three-pack of defensemen that can play the game at both ends of the rink, but are more known for what they do offensively, I'll say. Maybe Alec Martinez is more known for a two-way, but Theodore and Pietrangelo, real good weapons on the offensive side of the puck, as well as playing defense. And then they rounded out with Zach Whitecloud, who's had a very nice playoff for me, and Nick Holden, a placeholder on that third pairing, who's been very steady defensively as well. But in terms of star power, I think I give the edge to Vegas here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to, too, when you consider that Jeff Petry is out of the lineup. That's a huge blow to them. You know, he practiced today in a non-contact jersey, so certainly isn't going to play game one, probably. You know, I would call that doubtful to play game two if he hasn't been cleared for contact. And then you've got, you know, more of a depth guy, and maybe he wouldn't even play if they do decide to stick with Romanov. But you know, John Merrill being out for a while, that's hurting their blue line as well. So for me, I think the injuries, you know, are a big factor here to lose, you know, Petry, especially to have him not in the lineup, I think is a huge blow. for them, and is going to stretch their depth there. And as you said, the star power all goes to the other side of the ice. In terms of the forward compliments here, again, more injuries causing more problems for the Montreal Canadiens. Obviously, Jake Evans has been out since that first game. Jonathan Drouin's been away from the team, so they haven't had him at all for a while. Thomas Tatar has been banged up and out of the lineup, so they've really had to rely on kind of everybody chipping in due to those injuries. Atari Lehkonen gets the look on the top line without Evans, alongside Philip Deneau and Brendan Gallagher. The second line, I think, is where this team earns its bread and butter, with Tyler Toffoli, Nick Suzuki, and Cole Caulfield. But even their third line, Paul Byron, Jasper Kotkaniemi, Josh Anderson, is a solid group, albeit maybe a little less offense coming from them. And then this would be what I would maybe pick as the best fourth line in hockey right now, and Joel Armia, Eric Staal, and Corey Perry. I think they are all veteran guys capable of producing, and they have shown that. On the Vegas side, it's a little more top-heavy, in my opinion here. You've got your first line, Max Pacioretty, Chandler Stephenson, and Mark Stone. Second line, Jonathan Marchessault, William Karlsson, and Riley Smith. It drops off for me a little bit there in Matthias Janmark, Nicholas Waugh, and Alex Tuck. And then the fourth line, I think, just is built differently than some of the other fourth lines. You know, Ryan Reeves, Keegan Kolesar, and William Carey are going to be a bit of a rough and tumble group. Obviously, having Ryan Reeves, any line that he's on is going to be a little more rough and tumble there. So I do think maybe you give the edge in the top six to the Golden Knights, but if you're looking for complete depth of the forward group, I would give it the edge to the Habs here.
I'm kind of looking forward to seeing if those fourth lines will match up against one another for any significant periods of time. The experience factor has to be heavily in favor of Montreal, with Staal and Perry carrying that flag, but it's the physicality that the fourth liners for Vegas can if they take liberties with these guys, all hell could break loose here, I think, taking on the venerable part of the Montreal lineup with the respect they have for their veterans here. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But it's the third line for the Canadians that is a real enigma for me. Paul Byron and Josh Anderson, it's been hard to identify these guys in the postseason. Josh Anderson did get the first goal of these playoffs against the Maple Leafs, but he's been totally missing in action ever since then. AJ, it was his only point so far in the postseason. For all the skill that this guy brings to the table and all the money they're paying him, he's not delivering right now. And you wonder, is he hurt or what? Because he's just not playing very well, very hard to notice. And it's a wonder to me that Jesperi Kotkaniemi has been as notable as he has, because he's like the old story about playing center like a helicopter. You got no wings. So really, credit to him for being as prominent as he's been in the playoffs. For me, Suzuki and Caulfield and Toffoli, that's the key to the offense for Montreal, obviously. You know, the first line that we list on the RotoWire depth chart, Lehkonen, Deneau, and Gallagher, more primed for their defensive responsibilities that I expect out of them. Deneau, clearly their shutdown center, but you think he's going to get the opportunity to play against Vegas's top line, which features Chandler Stephenson, Stone, and Pacioretty. That's going to be their responsibility. But to me, the wild card in this set is the second line for the Knights, and I've talked about this a lot on the DraftKings format, so you'll hear it first here in our podcast. But Marchessault, Karlsson, and Riley Smith, they hold the key in this series for me, AJ. If they exert their advantage, I think that this could be a cakewalk for the Knights. If these guys play well, if they don't, they're in for a dogfight. So with that, we come to the point in the show where we have to put our predictions together for this series, and we are already on record. We said this already on the other network, but we'll repeat it here. I'm on the Knights in five games. I think the key to Montreal's hopes will ride with game one. If they can get an early knockdown of the Knights, this would be the opportunity, I think, to catch them a little cold without knowing too much about Montreal and get that surprise first win to cause some doubt. But if they don't, this will be a quick series.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree, Paul. I'm on Vegas in five. I think they're just a shade better all around in terms of what they can put on the ice. They've got all the offense. They've got the net minding. And so I really think they'll dispatch this pretty quickly. You know, as you alluded to, you know, Montreal traveling, obviously for the first two games, that's a big factor. And we've seen since they came into the league, the Vegas flu is a real thing. I think it'll be accentuated here by the sheer fact that the Canadians haven't played really in front of fans. I think they got 500 healthcare 20, workers at the last couple of games or something, but not the packed house that they're going to experience when they get into Las Vegas.
That's right. Now, wonder later in the series, if they do open the house up in Montreal, that remains to be seen. But you're quite right that they haven't faced a hostile audience yet in these postseason, and it'll be pretty rabid down in the capital of the entertainment world in the United States for me. That wraps up our look around the league, folks. Thanks for listening to Puckcast with Statsman and AJ. And as we implied, if you want to get more of us, don't forget to check out the DraftKings site on YouTube to see our daily prognostications and in a Q&A with the fine folks over there at DraftKings who apparently they like us, AJ. They love us, in fact. They're having us back every day. So we're having a ball with that, and thanks to them. So you've been listening to RotoWire's signature fantasy hockey podcast. Please remember to send your comments or questions on Twitter. Follow me, Paul Bruno, at Statsman22, and you can follow AJ at AJ24 Schultz. Let me try that again. At AJ Schultz24. As always, we invite you to listen into Puckcast to get our tips to stay out of the competition in your fantasy hockey planning and research. Don't forget, the next time you'll see us on this pod is to preview the Stanley Cup Final and review the two rounds that are taking place right now. So long, everybody.